Thank you, Gerard. It's a pleasure to be here in this distinguished academic environment to talk about one of my favorite topics, for which I did a lot of research during the last few years, on asynchronous circuits. So let me start by telling what will be the goal of this talk. And first of all, I would like to convince everybody that designing an asynchronous circuit is easy, contrary to what many people thought in the past. And I will try to show that the difference between synchronous and asynchronous is not that big. Okay, conceptually there are similar things, but also conceptually there are different things that make asynchronous circuits interesting. And I will try to show why doing circuits asynchronously has advantages. And I will not show any exotic asynchronous scheme to discourage designers to move into this area. For those who would like to see more about asynchronous circuits, you could look at the literature, and there is a lot written there. So what we have today is some challenging problem in designing complex circuits. And this is the last NVIDIA GPU, graphics processing unit. It has 7 billion transistors, American billion, and 2,688 CUDA cores. And the big challenge here, one of the big challenges, is how to distribute the clock just to trigger all the flip-flops in this system. And then how to determine what is the frequency of that clock, the timing analysis and guarantee that has a good performance, and how to implement robust communications between flip-flops and flip-flops. And moreover, we would like to do that being energetically efficient with little energy. So that's a big challenge. And what I will try to show today is that time is elastic. So we can adapt timing not to run always at a fixed frequency, but according to the requirements that we have for every computation. Okay, so, and this is about asynchronous circuits. We will try to relax the conditions for the fixed clock that we have in typical synchronous circuits. First of all, to understand that, I would like to remember how synchronous circuits work, some of the basics of synchronous circuits, just to understand later what we can relax. And basically, a synchronous circuit has a bunch of combinational logic, logic gates, and then flip-flops that memorize the data. And then there is a clock network that is distributing pulses generated mostly by a PLL at a fixed frequency. Okay. The latency of this network sometimes is even longer than the delay of the cycle period. And that's why sometimes we may have several pulses on the flight on the same clock network. That could be one or two cycles, the latency of the clock network. Okay. Let me go into the details about the timing in synchronous circuits. And let's assume that this green token on the top represents valid data. And let's look at two consecutive pulses generated by this PLL. And basically, this is the first pulse that is distributed all over the network. And then when it reaches the first flip-flop, it will just launch the data through the combinational logic. And the second pulse will just trigger the second flip-flop and will capture the data, okay? So there are two consecutive pulses that are related in the timing of this event. And let's see here that we have two competing paths in this circuit. One is the launching path and the other is the capturing path. What is the launching path? The launching path goes from the PLL to the clock network and then to the combinational logic to the second register. While the capturing path is also generated from the PLL, goes through the clock network, and goes to the receiving register. And there is some timing constraint that we need to meet just for this to work correctly. And this timing constraint is basically saying that the launching path should be shorter than the capturing path plus the period, because remember, for the capturing path, we're using the second pulse, which is one period later than the first pulse. And if we go into the details, basically that means that the launching path is the clock tree plus the combinational logic. For simplicity, let's imagine that the register has zero delay, or if you prefer, the delay is embedded in the combinational logic, right? The capturing path is basically the clock tree. And if we assume that the delays in the clock tree are basically the same, which means formally saying that we have no clock skew, then we have the main constraint for the synchronous circuits, which is that the period should be longer than the combinational path. Basically, the longest path in the combinational logic that we often call this the critical path, okay? So this is how a synchronous circuit works. Let's look at the small variation of synchronous circuits, something that is called source synchronous. And here we don't have a clock tree. Basically, we have a clock generator at the beginning of a linear pipeline. And instead of having a clock tree, what we have is a set of match delays. And these match delays, you can build them, for example, as chains of inverters. We also have similar timing constraints here. So for example, in one of the pipeline stages, we have a launching path, and we also have a capturing path. And then we have to adjust this match delay in a way that always the launching path is shorter than the capturing path as before. It's the same, right? This has some advantages. In particular, doing this with match delays, we have more tolerance to variability, and I will talk about this later. This is good for asynchronous pipelines. Acyclic pipelines. And again, here, the clock frequency must be adjusted to make that the period is always longer than the slowest pipeline stage. We can have even more sophisticated structures like acyclic pipelines with the forks and joins. So all these clouds represent a combinational logic. And so this is combinational logic, this is registers, and this is path. And here we have a join, for example, that could be another that receives two operands from two different sources and produces a result. Okay. Again, here, we need a similar clocking structure. We can make it acyclic with a clock generator. This is buffers that are triggering just the resistors. And here we have these match delays, chains of inverters, for example, that are matching the delay of the combinational logic. So how this works? So the clock generator is just sending pulses that go along these delays, okay? And at a certain point here, we have a situation in which one of the tokens arrives before the other, because maybe one of the paths is shorter than the other. But we have to wait for the other data, imagine this is an addition, just to complete the operation. So we will have to wait for that, and then we will have to synchronize these two events here, okay? And one of the questions is how to synchronize these incoming events. So we will look into that. Once they have been synchronized, then we can say, okay, this data is valid, so we can trigger the next register and send data forward, okay? So how to synchronize these incoming events? And one way to do that is using a very popular logic gate, which is a sequential gate for asynchronous design, which is the C element, invented by Muller a long time ago. And here you have the truth table of the C element. Basically, the way it works is when the two inputs have the same value, then this value is propagated to the output. Okay? When you have 0, 0, 1, 1, propagated to the output. If the inputs have different value, then it keeps the previous value, so it has memory. And this is used just to synchronize events. And here at the bottom, we have a timing diagram where we see inputs A, B, and C. And whenever two pulses are received or two H's are received from A and B, then this is propagated to C. And then here we are waiting for the falling H's of A and B. This is propagated to C, and so on and so forth. Okay? So this is a synchronizer of events, waiting for one event, another event, and then propagating the event. It's like the conjunction, but in terms of events, not levels. And how to implement a C element? Well, if you go to standard cell library, you can use the majority gate. There are different ways of implementing it at transistor level, but the majority gate is sufficient, just putting a feedback from the output to the input. A majority gate is a gate in which there is a both from the three inputs and the majority gains, right? So if A and B are the same, have the same value, this will be propagated to C. If A and B have different value, then C will determine the next value, right? And you can even build multi-input C elements as a cascade of two-input C elements, okay? That basically synchronizes all the inputs having the same value and propagated to the output. So let's talk now about completion detection. What is this about? So let's look at one of those stages in the source synchronous approach. And here we have the match delay that can be built, as I mentioned, as a chain of inverters. And the idea here is that this delay should always be longer than any possible delay here. And for that, you have to be conservative. You have to take into account always the worst case delay. And moreover, you have to add some margins for variability, okay, which is not negligible. But we know that many operations take variable delays. For example, let's assume an addition. An addition, the delay of an addition depends mostly on the carry propagation. So if we take a ripple carry adder, so if we, the carry propagation is only 1 or 2 bits, then we will complete the addition very soon. If there is a long carry propagation, then it will be very late. And the question is, could we take advantage of this variability and say, can we detect as soon as possible when an operation has completed? And there are mechanisms to do that. So let me explain one of them, which is basically using delay-insensitive codes. There are many delay-insensitive codes, but probably the most popular is the dual rail. And basically, it works as follows. Every bit of information is encoded with two wires, two signals, okay? And we call this, so the bit is called A, so we use two wires, A dot true, A dot false. And the encoding is as follows. When both are zero, that means information is not valid. We call this a spacer. Okay? When one of them is one, then depending on which one is asserted, then we're representing the logic zero or the logic one. Okay, if the false is asserted, that means the logic zero. If the true is asserted, it means the logic one. And the combination 1-1 is not used in this particular encoding. So here at the bottom, we see a timing diagram showing data transfer of 4 bits. And basically, this represents the transfer of 1-0-1-1. Okay, so here we assert the true, here we assert the false. And we see that between every pair of bits, we have a spacer. And we need that to distinguish when the transmission of one bit is finishing and the initiation of the other starts, right? So we need these spacers. We always have a value spacer, and so on and so forth. This is how dual rail works. Let's try to do some logic. So let's try to implement a dual rail AND gate. So we have here the bits A and B, encoded in dual rail, and this is the truth table, right? Saying, well, when we have a spacers in A and B, so the output is a spacer, no valid data. But as soon as one of the inputs is zero, then we can tell that the output will be zero, okay? If both inputs are one, then we can tell that the output is one. But if one input is one and the other is a spacer, of course, we cannot determine still the value of the output. So we have to wait for the other to become valid. So how can we implement that? And one way is, for example, like this. So this is a dual rail AND gate. And here we see that the true value is the conjunction of the true values. It will be false when either one or the other is false, right? We can also see that if all the wires are at zero, I mean a spacer, the output will be spacer, okay? Let's do another gate, the dual rail inverter. And this is pretty simple, because what we want is there is a spacer at the input, the spacer at the output, and when there is valid data, it should be complemented. So how can we implement an inverter in dual rail logic? So it is as simple as changing the semantic of the wires. So the false becomes true, and the true becomes false. So there is no logic gate. It's for free, well, not exactly for free. You have wires, it's not totally for free. But this is how you implement the inverter, right? And then we can think about implementing AND and OR gates. So we saw before the implementation of an AND gate. And we may think, okay, how could we implement the OR gate? Well, taking into account the inverters are for free, then we can apply the Morgan's law and just see that the equivalence of an OR gate, it's an AND gate with the inputs and outputs inverted, right? So we can just take the same implementation. The only thing we have to do is to cross the wires at the inputs and at the outputs. So the same implementation can be used for AND or OR, depending on how you connect the wires. Okay? And then here, we can start thinking about netlists, clouds of combinational logic implemented with dual rail. So here we have pairs of wires representing signals. And let's assume at the beginning, in this dual rail implementation, all the inputs have spacers, and these are propagated to the outputs as spacers. So we are in a reset state. The way this dual rail logic will operate is that the inputs will start arriving and then will start propagating through the dual rail logic, and the outputs will become stable. And as soon as the computation is finished, we'll be able to know that. And how? Well, basically, we can put a completion detection tree. So how do we know that an operation has completed? Because at all the pairs of outputs, we see that one of the bits is one. Okay? As soon as it's one, then it is completed. And when we have this for all the outputs, we can put just the C element, say, and say the computation is done. As soon as it is completed, then we can determine that, right? And then after the computation in dual rail logic, we have to reset the whole circuit. So we have to send a wave of spacers just to propagate all the spacers to the output and to detect that we have reset the circuit. And then we will do another computation and so on and so forth. Okay? So this is how basically dual rail works. And here now we can assume that we have an implementation of a dual rail circuit. So instead of putting this fixed delay, instead of that this delay always takes into account the worst case delay in this combinational logic, we can substitute this by completion detection trees. So we put these OR gates here that indicate when all the bits are finished, right? And this will trigger the flip-flops that will store data, and the same here. So see that this pulse here will be issued as soon as the computation has completed. Okay, we don't have to wait for the worst critical path, because the critical path is not always exercised at every cycle. So sometimes it's exercised, sometimes it's not. So we can be faster with that. So let's compare the single rail with the dual rail. And single rail is the conventional way in which we represent only one wire per bit, right? And let's normalize this data. So let's do some back of the envelope computations, saying, well, in single rail, let's assume that the area, which is equivalent to the number of transistors or devices, so we normalize to one, right? In dual rail, we have to double everything more or less, duplicate wires, gates, and all these things. So this is bad news. But in terms of delay, I mean, in single rail, let's assume that our cycle is 1 nanosecond, right? In dual rail, well, sometimes it can be 1 nanosecond, but many times it can be shorter than that, so we can go faster. We have some overhead because of these completion detection trees, but we can go as fast as the technology allows us to go. The bad news are for power consumption or energy, because we have two components, the static power and the dynamic power. And the static power, which is the leakage current, mostly depends on the number of devices. And since we have a double number of devices, so the static power also doubles. And the really bad news is for dynamic power. The dynamic power mostly depends on the switching activity of the circuit. So if you ask designers, what is the switching activity of your circuit? Most of them will tell, well, it's very small, 5, 10%, maybe 15%, no more than 20%. And mostly because in most systems, there are a lot of zeros there that are not used. So we usually use short operands for the operations. Memory is plenty of zeros. So there is not much activity. So let's assume less than 20%. However, in dual rail, it doesn't matter the activity you have. So that every cycle, you have to put a spacer and then move to 0-1. A spacer and 0-1. So every signal will have two transitions, from 1 to 0 to 0 to 1. So that's an order of magnitude more in power. That's really bad news. So if you want to go for the speed, you are desperate for the speed, dual rail can be an option. If you want to go for power, then probably that's not the best idea. So I didn't talk about asynchronous circuits yet, totally pure asynchronous circuits. We are moving into there. So handshaking, that's the key issue. So let's assume now that we have also our source synchronous scheme, but we don't know the delay of this component. Okay, and sometimes it can have long delay, sometimes short delay, but we don't know anything about it. If we don't know anything, then it's very difficult to determine a frequency for this clock generator. Okay, so we need some other mechanism just for two components, the sender and receiver of data, to talk reliably and meet timing constraints. And here is where we introduce the handshaking. And let's assume here that we have just a latch that is separating the data transfer between a sender and a receiver. And we put some control circuit here that it's triggering, it's generating the clock for this latch. And we'll have pairs of wires, so we have a bidirectional communication between the controllers just to indicate two facts. One is that the sender has data, okay? This will indicate that there is valid data here. And the other is that the receiver is allowed to store data because it has some empty space to store that. And it works as follows. So let's assume that the sender has some valid data. And this red token represents valid data. And we'll indicate this with this control signal. OK, since the receiver didn't mention anything about having willing data, then this token will stop here. And basically, when the receiver says, I want data, they will interchange data. And this will propagate saying there is valid data here. And this will propagate backwards saying, OK, we have a space now. OK, we want more data. It can be the other way around. It can be that the receiver is the one that it's faster, saying, I want some food to eat. But the sender is slow or lazy. Maybe it took some time to produce data. So the receiver will wait until the sender will produce new data. They will interchange, okay, and will handshake. These bidirectional signals in asynchronous design, they are typically called request and acknowledge. So let's see now in a typical asynchronous elastic pipeline that was proposed in different versions by Muller in the late 50s, and then Ivan Sutherland. He called it micropipelines. It was the Turing Award lecture he gave when he received the prize. And here we see how this, the request and acknowledge signals, how they handshake. And here we see some C elements that produce pulses or events that will trigger these latches. So here I don't put any combinational logic. We only have, it's a pipeline that sends data from stage to stage. And each time we open a latch, some valid data moves from one place to another. So what we see here is just every C element has two inputs. One comes from the previous stage, the other from the next stage. And the availability of token here at the left input indicates that there is data available. And a token here means that there is a space. This space, we call it bubble. And we can make a data transfer when there is data at one side and bubble at the other side. Otherwise, we would overwrite data or we would send invalid data. Okay? So here we see that this C element is ready to generate a pulse to move this from here to here, and this also. But this one is not ready to produce any pulse because it has no token here, basically because we would overwrite this data. Okay? And this one has, it's the worst case in which it has no valid data and has no space. But let's see how this pipeline evolves. So we can fire, for example, this C element, okay, and then the tokens will move to the neighbors, indicating, okay, I did a data transfer. Now, for example, we can fire this and this, and this can be done concurrently, okay? And you know the rules of the game. Each time a C element has two inputs, that means that we have token and bubble, and we can make data transfer. And they can be done independently. You see that there is no global clock. Everything is local communication distributed, and it's done as soon as it can, independently of the rest of the pipeline. So I hope that makes clear how an asynchronous elastic pipeline works, right? So let's go to something more sophisticated. So it's not only for a linear pipeline, it can be any structure, and in particular, for example, here we could have an adder with two inputs, and this goes stored into a register with multiple outputs. So we can also build that with putting these controllers. So basically here we will have the C elements and pairs of handshake signals that only interact with the controllers that locally have a relationship in terms of paths in the data path. Okay. In these lines, we will also put the delays, and these delays will mimic the delay in the path that goes from register to register. Okay. And here, basically, what we'll have is just a C element, a multi-input C element, receiving all the request signals and receiving all the acknowledgement signals from the following stages. And now, based on that, now we can propose a different paradigm in designing systems. So in synchronous systems, we communicate sending data, and then we trust on the clock, which is the same clock typically. We can have multi-clock systems, but just let's assume that we have the same clock in all components just to sample the data. Now we don't have a common clock. The clock is distributed, so we have ring oscillators there just producing data and sending data. And the way to communicate, to synchronize, is through the handshake signals, the request and acknowledge, okay? And basically, each time we want to send data, we have to send a request. When the receiver is able to capture the data, then it will send an acknowledgement, and then we are ready to submit the next data, and so on and so forth. And this can be done in both directions. So let's see these request acknowledge signals, so these signals in the channel, how they interact physically, some more details. So they need a protocol, okay? And this is one of the potential protocols. This is a two-phase protocol. In this protocol, a data transfer is produced each time the handshake signals have an event. So here we see the request signal going high. That means new data is valid and is transferred. And then the acknowledgement signal is raised by the receiver. So the following event, data transfer, is produced on the following edge of request. So we see here that there is no distinction between the rising edge and the falling edge. The semantics is the same. It's just an event on the signal that indicates that the data transfer should be produced. And this is called a two-phase protocol because every data transfer has two events, one request and one acknowledgement. We have another family of protocols. There are different variations of this protocol, which is called a four-phase protocol. And here, only the rising edges of the request and acknowledge are meaningful. Well, there are several variations of that. Sometimes we can choose to be the falling edge, whatever, right? But before doing another data transfer, after the request and acknowledgement, these two signals have to go to zero. This is the return to zero. It's just events that we have to insert just to start the next data transfer with the same rising edges. There are advantages and disadvantages of using one or the other. I will not go into the details and see some implementation details on how to use them. So for example, now what we'll have in our asynchronous circuits is latches, combinational logic, and then we have these C elements which are handshaking with the next stage. This delay just matching the delay of the combinational logic. And basically what we see here is just, this is a ring oscillator. See that we have an inversion here. In all ring oscillators, you need an odd number of inverters to oscillate. And we can use either a two-phase or four-phase protocol in this ring oscillator. Two-phase means that each time we do one lap here, we will do one data transfer. Four-phase means that if we do, we need two laps to do one data transfer. And basically, the question is, what do we have to put here to generate the appropriate pulses for this latch? And basically what we will see is just the token. So this ring oscillator will handshake, but will produce just events in this way, right? So we'll see a rising signal, falling edge, rising edge, falling edge at each one of these laps. So let's assume that we use a two-phase protocol. For a two-phase protocol, basically what we need is that at every lap, we have to generate a pulse for the latch. So every edge needs to generate a pulse. How can we do that? This is a possible implementation. This is an exclusive OR gate and just some delay. And this delay what corresponds to the pulse width in this latch, okay? That's a possible implementation. We can go to the four-phase protocol in which we don't need anything here, basically. But here the difference is that every two laps we do one data transfer because here we need two edges. Here there is some small subtleties, so we know that this delay should be matched with the combinational logic. But since here we take two laps and do a data transfer, this delay in fact should match half of the delay of the combinational logic plus margins for variability. Okay, that's something that should be taken into account when designing this type of circuits. So let's look a little bit now at performance analysis. So in a synchronous circuit, it's very easy to know how fast it's going. So just look at the frequency of the clock. That means how many operations you are doing at what speed, right? In asynchronous systems, it's not that simple because basically what we have is a set of ring oscillators, that are handshaking through C elements. And this is what we saw, for example, in the elastic pipeline before, just C elements that are synchronizing ring oscillators. And here we have, for example, an arbitrary scheme of ring oscillators that are handshaking through C elements. Let me tell something, well, it's not shown here, but these oscillators have certain delay. We need an odd number of inverters just for them to oscillate. And what we will see here, basically, is that the slowest ring is the one that determines the performance of the system. So let's look at this animation just to understand better how it works. So let's focus first on the two ring oscillators on the top, 6 and 7, okay? And we see here that one of them is faster than the other. 6 is faster than 7. But they do the same number of flaps because they synchronize. And in this case, 6 is always waiting for 7. So that means that in this small subsystem, 6, 7, the frequency or the period is determined by the ring number 7, which is the slowest. Now, let's look at the most complex structure with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. They are totally disconnected from 6, 7, so they are independent. And let's see here that there is one of the rings that is determining the cycle period, the slowest one. We see here, for example, 1 is very fast, 2 is slower, so 1 is constrained by 2, but 2 also has to wait by 3. 3 seems to be short, but it has to wait a lot for 4, and 5 also relatively fast, but has to wait for 4. There is one of the rings that never waits, okay? One of the tokens that never waits, never stops. And this is number 4. It's always the latest to arrive at every C element. The rest are just waiting for it, okay? So this is the one that determines the performance of the system. But the interesting part here is that at this precise moment, 4 is the slowest. But in the future, maybe for the operating conditions may change, the temperature, voltage fluctuations, or whatever, maybe this one becomes the slowest. Okay? That may change dynamically for whatever reasons. And then the system will adapt automatically to the slowest component because they have this handshaking mechanism. Okay? And that's very important in the adaptability of asynchronous systems to the variation of the working conditions. So, after knowing a little bit of the basics of asynchronous circuits, we may ask, why should we move into this area? Why should we design asynchronous circuits? And there are several reasons, but I will focus on two of them that for me are the most important. One is modularity. So if we design asynchronously, we don't have a global clock, And then we can play just, it's like an object-oriented hardware design. You can substitute one component by another with different timing without having to change the rest of the system. So for example, we can change component B by another B prime that has the same functionality. Maybe it has different timing, different performance, maybe better, maybe worse, but the functionality of the complete system will not change, okay, as long as we keep the protocol in these handshake components. I think that's an interesting property, modularity. The other thing is about adaptability to the variability. And we know that variability is an important issue today. Today we are, soon we will have commercial products designed at 14 nanometers. Intel, I think, is promising for the end of the year or maybe next year. At this scale, the variability of the circuit is increasing drastically. And here, for example, one of the problems we have to solve in asynchronous design is to design this match delay. And in this match delay should always cover the worst case in the critical path that we have in the combinational logic, okay? And in fact, we don't have one critical path. We have many critical paths that, depending on the operating conditions, may become longer or shorter. And not all paths have the same sensitivity to the operating conditions, okay, to the changes in temperature, in voltage. So this represents different corners, different operating conditions, more temperature, less voltage, or whatever. Typically, they are called the best, typical, and worst, but there are many corners for design. Okay, and these are critical paths that have different delays. So basically, what we have to design is a match delay that is well correlated with the delay of the critical path. And this is the match delay that will be built out of a bunch of gates and wires, okay, that in such a way that the delay of this red path, that is the match delay, it's always longer than any critical path and any conditions, any operating conditions. Okay, designing that, it's a real challenge, but it's doable. Okay, there are ways to do that. And basically, the good thing about this is that there is a good correlation. So this match delay and the critical path are in the same region in the circuit. That means that for the process variability, the systematic process variability, this is the variability that affects more or less uniformly to all devices in the same region. So they share this variability. Okay? When there are voltage fluctuations, these fluctuations affect the delay of the circuit, but also the match delay, the clock. This doesn't happen with a rigid clock, with a PLL, because a PLL has a very fixed frequency, doesn't have fluctuations, at least with the operating conditions. Also with temperature and also with aging, because the circuits also have some aging, they go slower with time, but the same happens with the match delay. So this correlation is very good. And basically, here we are showing how designers are determining the cycle period. So we have some nominal gate and wire delays, okay, the normal delays. But on top of that, we have to put a lot of margins just to cover this variability. And these margins must be conservative because we cannot fail. We can never fail. So we have margins for process variability, for voltage variability, temperature, the jitter of the PLL, the aging of the circuit, the clock skew, and some other margins. And all these are there. And we know that possibly we could run the circuit much faster most of the times, but we cannot run because just in case something happened. With elastic clocks, this is how we call sometimes the asynchronous circuits. We say that they are using elastic clocks. So we need margins, but these margins are much smaller because the clock, the cycle period, is correlated with the delay of the circuit. And I'm trying to show this with this animation. So when we have a rigid clock, basically we determine a fixed cycle period, but the computation time, depending on the data, on the operating conditions, sometimes is shorter, sometimes is longer, but all this time that we have here that is not used is wasted time, okay? When we use asynchronous circuits, basically we have a worst case cycle period, but the period is determined by the match delay, which is also changing dynamically because it's suffering all the fluctuations, all the variability that is suffering the same circuit. Okay, so there is a worst case, of course, but on average, the cycle period is better. So here is where we can save, we can have better performance, or if you prefer, you can sacrifice performance and have, for the same performance, less power. So let me show an experiment that was done in a company that was, I was one of the co-founders a few years ago, was called Elastics, and we did an experiment putting on the same chip three ARM cores, three small ARM microprocessors, so they were suffering the same variability. And basically here what we see is that taking into account the worst case margins, we could run in 1 volt, at 1 volt, we could run this at about 330 megahertz. That's the speed of the circuit. Well, we apply also some of the new techniques of voltage scaling. And then, in voltage scaling, what you could do is, with the same voltage, you can run probably much higher, but you can choose between having a high voltage, high speed, or low voltage and lower speed. But taking the same frequency, we could run at 0.87, something like this, volts, so we could save like 24% of power. But adding the elastic clocks on top of that, we could add an extra 14%. That means that by using elastic clock with respect to the worst case delay that you have in rigid clocks, you can save like 35-40%, depending on the samples and the circuits, of power. And that's a lot today. That's a lot. And let me finish just a little bit with design automation. So I would like to explain a little bit some different options that we have to design asynchronous circuits using some design tools. And I will explain very briefly three different paradigms of different tools that have been created mostly in academia, not in industry, some of them in industry, but mostly in academia. One is about the synthesis of asynchronous controllers, how to design these control circuits in the handshake mechanisms. And I will show how we can do logic synthesis from PetriNets or asynchronous finite state machines. Then I will go for a nice paradigm, which is syntax-directed translation that can possibly be a similar method that is used for synchronous language like Esterel. And we achieve correct by construction circuits using handshake components. And then I will talk about the new paradigm that we proposed a few years ago, which is called desynchronization, which means how to move from synchronous circuit to asynchronous automatically. Since people are scared about designing asynchronous circuits, the message is we tell them, just design it synchronously, we'll have a tool to translate automatically into asynchronous. So let's start by the first, very briefly, how to synthesize asynchronous controllers. And probably many of you are familiar with timing diagrams, which are used to just specify protocols. And in the timing diagrams, what you see is events of the signals and causality relations. And this is the rich cycle of a VME bus controller, for example. So these timing diagrams can be translated into some formal specification. And this is the same formal specification of this. You see the causality relations here. This is a PetriNet, basically. It can be done also with some other formalisms like asynchronous finite state machines. And without going into details, what I can tell you is that from these formalisms, we can push the button and we have tools that can derive a bunch of gates that implement that protocol. Okay? So there is a lot of theory done on that. And for example, one of the tools that was designed by our group, it's called Petrify. And you can specify everything in PetriNets and generate a circuit. The events in these PetriNets represent, this is the rising transition and the falling transition of signals, the plus and the minus. Okay, so we're saying what is first, say some concurrency, causality, and so on and so forth. Let me go to another paradigm that has been also very successful in academia, which is syntax-directed translation. And the basis here is to take some of the concurrent languages, for example, CSP. And CSP is basically about processes and how they how you can do concurrency with processes and so on and so forth, right? So let's imagine that we have a process P that it's a composition of three other processes, and that means that process A and B are executed in parallel, and then after that we execute C. And doesn't matter what A and B and C means at this point. So we can implement each process as a box in which we have two signals, which are the two handshake signals, the request and acknowledge. And then when a token arrives here, basically that means that we request the execution of this process. It will execute, it will do some actions inside, and when it's completed, it will give an acknowledgement. Let's refine this and let's see what it means, the sequential, for example. So that basically means that this is the sequential composition of this process and this process. And this is a sequential element, which is an asynchronous controller that is just distributing the control sequentially to the two processes. So this will work as follows. So we give a request here. It will go execute A, B parallel, and then we'll execute C, and we'll give the acknowledgement. Okay? Let's refine a little bit more. And here we have a parallel composition of A and B. So basically, this is a request acknowledgement signal, right? So how does it work? So first, when we trigger this sequential element, say, okay, we will first execute the left part, and when arriving here, saying, okay, we have a parallel execution. So we'll execute in parallel two tokens, right? A and B, and then they will synchronize, they will wait for each other, and when they are completed, then it will return to the sequential element that will execute C and will return the control, okay? So we can also have a forever loop, which is this asterisk, this A and B repeated forever. So when something arrives here, see that here we don't have any acknowledgement signal because this will never finish, right? So we only need to trigger that. And when we trigger that, basically what we do is just a sequential composition. When it finishes, this component will return and will do another handshake and so on and so forth forever, right? So this is about control signals, but we can have also data components. For example, another. Another will have two channels, two input channels, and one output channel. And the way it will work is some data will arrive with the request signal. Then we will have to wait for the other to arrive. And when both are there at the inputs, they will just do the addition, will synchronize. And when C has completed storing the signal, it will return back and give an acknowledgement that will be propagated back to A and B. And for example, this is one of the examples of a circuit that calculates the greatest common divisor using Euclid's algorithm. You can specify data and you can specify channels for input and output. And then here you have an algorithm which is forever doing reading two inputs, then computing the greatest common divisor, Euclid's algorithm, and then writing the output. And here we see some components. For example, the sequential here, this is the forever loop, the asterisk. This is forever loop. This is the sequential with three statements. This is the in, the do, and the out that are separated by this semicolon. We can see some variables with the read and write ports. This is the x and the y variables. We can see the subtractor here, demultiplexers, input and output channels. This is the input channel, this is the output channel, and so on and so forth. So this works according to this specification using these handshake components, and it works. It's correct by construction, basically. And finally, let me talk just a little bit about the desynchronization idea. So here, the idea was the following. So many people were seeing asynchronous circuits like something exotic, difficult. I don't want to go into this world because I don't understand very well how they work sometimes. So we say, okay, let's try to do this very simple. You design a synchronous circuit, you know how to do this, you have tools for that, and then we will modify it and we'll transform into asynchronous. And we will get the advantages of asynchronous circuits, like the modularity, the tolerance to the variability. So how this is done? So if we look at the asynchronous circuit, so basically we have a clock generator and then pairs of master-slave latches. Basically, because a flip-flop is just a pair of latches, it's a master and slave. And they are moving always synchronously, from master to slave, or slave to master. This is what the clock pulses are doing, right? So instead of that, what we do is we don't change the combinational logic, we don't change the latches, we simply change the clock network by this. And this is basically the ring oscillators with the handshake components. Here we have the C elements producing the pulses for the latches. Okay, and here we have the match delay. We substituted the PLL that works a certain frequency by this match delay that determines the frequency of this ring oscillator. And of course here, the operation is equivalent, but it's more desynchronized. So the tokens are moving just according to the handshake components and tolerating variability. So here we get the advantages of asynchronous circuits, reducing the margins to make this work. And basically we reduce the margins because this is very well correlated with this. We don't need a PLL that needs a lot of margins to take into account the worst case frequency. And stop this. And I would like to conclude just saying that what asynchrony offers is flexibility in time. So we can adapt to many things, right? We can adapt to the computation times that may change because of the input data, but they may also change because of the operating conditions or because of the variability, static or dynamic variability of the circuit. So the asynchronous circuits offer this flexibility. That means that we can optimize them better for performance or power or both. If you can optimize performance, you can use this optimization to sacrifice it and optimize power. So they are just two variables in the same equation, okay? The question is, why most people are not using asynchronous circuits commercially? And here the main problem is the support of EDA tools. So in synchronous circuits, everybody understands that you have some major vendors like Synopsys, Cadence, or Mentor. They offer these timing analysis tools that they all trust on the existence of a clock, and then there you can determine the frequency of your system and verify that it's correct according to timing. This support does not exist for asynchronous circuits, okay? And another thing is that designers do not feel comfortable with this idea that timing is unpredictable, because they always ask you, what is the frequency of your system? They say, well, you have to answer, frequency is changing with time, right? And they don't feel a lot comfortable, but even there are some advantages, they see still like an obscure way of designing circuits. There are other aspects like testing and verification. I didn't talk about it, but they can be solved. And what we propose is that this synchronization paradigm could be a viable solution, because basically you can design synchronously and transform into asynchronous, and more or less the same timing analysis tools that you can use for synchronous circuits, they can be slightly adapted for asynchronous circuits. And we think that that could be a viable solution. Of course, there are many other ways of designing asynchronous circuits, other paradigms that are a little bit more sophisticated. And if you are interested, you could look at the literature. And yeah, I would like to conclude just, and if you have any questions, I will be happy to answer. Thank you.